Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he has written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Michael Shackelford is the force behind the websites Wizard of Odds, Wizard of Vegas, and Wizard of Macau. An actuary by profession, Michael has been analyzing the whole gamut of casino games since 1995. His Wizard of Odds website explains the best strategies for 140 different casino games. Michael is also the author of Gambling 102, The Best Strategies for All Casino Games, and is a former adjunct professor of gaming math at UNLV. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you will be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Mike.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. My name is Bob Dancer.
And I'm Mike Shackelford.
Our guest tonight will be Don Schlesinger, one of the all-time greats in blackjack, whose book, Blackjack Attack, is must reading for all serious players. We'll be talking to Don in about 15 minutes. This past week, we received an email at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com asking about some general information about cash drawings in casinos. I know we've spoken about this in the past, but it's important enough to address again. The biggest questions in drawings are, how much are the drawings worth, and what does it cost you to enter in terms of both time and money? If everybody gets one drawing tickets, which happens at some drawings, it's relatively easy to find out how much the drawing is worth. It's simply the total prize pool divided by the number of entrants. Usually you can get reasonable estimates of both of those. If players can earn tickets while playing, every $100 gets you an extra ticket, it's much, much more difficult to be able to figure out how many tickets will be in the drum. The best estimate of how much a drawing is worth is how much was it worth last time. Casinos tend to run variations of the same promotion over and over again. You need to keep track of how many entries you have for each drawing and what your results were. Share this information with others and they'll share with you. And over time, you're going to get some estimate as to whether the drawing is worth 0.1, 0.5, some such number. These are important numbers, and it takes time to figure this out. Now, if this is your first experience with a particular casino's drawing, and you can't get information out of anybody, then you're just going to have to swag it. Swag is an acronym meaning scientific wild-ass guess. That's what you're going to have to do. Now, you need to look at what games you're going to be playing and what other promotions are happening at the same time. If the other promotions and the games add up to close to 100%, then a drawing on top of that is likely to be a smart play. If the other promotions in the game only add up to 98%, it would be an unusual drawing that was worth enough to make up for that 2% shortfall. Not impossible, but just unusual. Now, drawings take time and energy to participate in. You usually have to drive to the casino, park, be there early enough to activate your tickets, deal with the crowds, etc. This is not costless. At a minimum, you have opportunity cost, meaning you can't be at another drawing at the same time somewhere else, or at a concert you wanted to see, or on a date with your sweetie. I can assure you that Shirley never considered going to a drawing to be anything that counted as a date night to her. You need to learn which machines generate the most tickets. At the Palms, playing the same game on different machines generates different numbers of tickets. You need to learn about this. This is your first experience at a casino, you have no idea, but over time you learn these things. You need to consider whether this drawing is based on your kind of play. I was once in a drawing where it took $50,000 a coin in to earn one ticket. this was a showstopper for many, many players. You needed to be able to, and willing to play a lot to have a chance in that drawing. You need to check out whether free tickets are available to everybody. Now, a bad example of this is what we talked about last week at the Silverton, where the most number of tickets you're allowed to win each day is 50, but anybody can come in off the streets and get 5 tickets just for asking for it. So the ratio of earned tickets to free tickets makes it so you never have a really good chance there. You need to read the rules for each drawing. They're often loopholes. Casinos tend to be lazy and use last year's rules for this year's drawing. They might not fit into, and then rules may not fit into every case. Now, one of those situations happened today, and I'm going to tell you about it in a few seconds. Now, sometimes there's ways to gain an advantage that you won't realize if you don't read the rules. Players often start too early to earn tickets, or play too late, or on the wrong machines, or after the fact they found out that they weren't eligible in the first place. The excuse of nobody told me doesn't fly very far when the rules are readily available. In addition to knowing the rules, you need to know how the rules are enforced. A good example of how a savvy player can gain an advantage is by knowing, like an example today that happened at the Gold Coast. Today, the Gold Coast had 3 drawings, well, 2 so far and 1 later, at 12:15, 4:15, and 8:15. As we're taping this, it is 7:08 in the evening, so immediately after this show, I'm rushing out for their last drawing. Now, this was technical stuff, iPads, TVs, computers. Now, Thursday at the Gold Coast is 10 times drawing ticket days, meaning that you earn 10 times as many drawing tickets as you do on other days of the week. The way it works there is during the day itself, all your tickets are multiplied by 10. And then after midnight, the computer program runs and slices off everything up to the limit of $10,000 coin in, gives you the maximum number of tickets. But today, this is the first time they've ever had a drawing on Thursdays. So the ticket to erase the excess won't be run until well after the drawing takes place. So a few savvy players realize that they could earn 3 or 5 or 8 times as many tickets as any of the people who just automatically stopped after 10,000, because that's the way they always do it there. If you're not used to the rules or not thinking about how actively to take a part of it, you would not have caught that. You need to take what else is happening into consideration. At the Palm, for example, they have regular weekly drawings. Players earn tickets by their play, and partially on the Monday, Wednesday, Friday, they have the play, earn, and win, where you play a certain amount and get prizes. This month, the first half of the month, you could earn Apple gift certificates. The second half of the month, you can earn Visa cards. These are better than average gifts, and so players are playing more for those because they want the Apple gift cards or they want the Visa cards, which means on the Friday and Saturday night drawings at the Palms in April, you need more tickets in the barrel to have the same chance as you had in March, because in March the prices weren't quite so attractive. In the same vein, if they have an unusual multiple point day just before the drawing, expect that you're going to need extra play to win. This can cut the opposite way. If 2 casinos that largely appeal to the same customers both have drawings at the same time, this can be a great time to play at one of the casinos, because half of your competition is going to be at the other casino's event. You need to plan for the drawings. If 2 casinos both have weekly drawings that run at the same time, you need 1 week you play at one casino and 1 week you play at the other. If you do your normal play both weeks at both casinos, then what that means is on each drawing you're in, you only have half the number of tickets in the drum as if you specialized. In Las Vegas, among local players today, several casinos would be unprofitable except for these drawings. At these casinos, almost you must participate in the drawings to be successful. players who choose not to do this for whatever reasons are giving up very valuable EV. Michael, what are your comments on this general subject?
I agree with everything you said. The most important thing is to know the rules of these drawings. And it isn't enough to just read one thing about the rules if it's written in multiple places. You should read the written rules every opportunity that they're given to you. And this is not the kind of thing you want to skim. You want to read them very carefully. Another thing, piece of advice that I would give is, as you mentioned this, is activating. And maybe recreational players that don't do drawings very often might not know that at some casinos it isn't enough to just put your card in and play. You then have to activate your tickets, and that usually involves asking a particular person or going to the club booth and saying, I'm in this drawing, please activate my tickets.
Or swipe at a kiosk frequently.
Yes, it's done different ways in different places, and personally I think it's an annoying, unnecessary step. But
I think it's an extremely useful step. I want to, if they're going to give away 10 winners, mm-hmm. and they have to draw 75 because a lot of tickets in the barrel aren't people there, that just takes forever. I would rather them just drawing people have a good shot at being there.
That's a good point. I didn't think that that's the reason that they did that. But one time I didn't know I was supposed to activate my tickets, and I did all this play for nothing, and I felt like quite the fool. Another thing that's worth mentioning is that with table game tournaments where you earn points for, say, getting a blackjack or getting a suited natural in Baccarat, they will give you so many points every time these occur, and there will be employees around with big stacks of tickets. I've found that there's a lot of
shenanigans.
Yes, there's a lot of favoritism with these passing out of tickets, and the employees will give way more than they're supposed to people that they're friendly with. And I've seen this before. And if you're not above taking advantage of that, then asking different employees for the tickets and tipping, you'll probably find out which employee is bribable. I don't like this. I usually will not even engage in tournaments where the employees carry around piles of tickets because I know that some players are going to have more favoritism than me.
And sometimes you actually have to ask for it. So if you get a suited blackjack or something, you will get a ticket if you ask for it. And if you don't ask for it, you don't get it.
Exactly. You absolutely must ask for it. And lots of times if the tickets you get are proportional to the amount that you bet, and if you bet a lot, the person that's giving out the tickets may just grab a whole bunch of them. And I think that if you were tipping, he would be more likely to open up his hand wider.
I'm sure that's the case. And I'm also sure that in most Vegas casinos anyway, where they have both slots and table games in the same drawing, the rules are such that a table game player can legally get 10 tickets an hour and a video poker player can get 2,000 tickets an hour. And so it doesn't lead to very fair playing field, but that's the way they do it.
And if in tournaments like that are table games only, you should study what it takes to get a ticket in each game, the probability, the house edge in that game, and to determine which game should I play to maximize the greatest number of tickets at the lowest possible cost. And usually these drawings are constructed very badly, where certain games have a huge advantage over others. Like in Pai Gow Tiles, maybe you get a ticket every time you get a Gi Jun pair, which is extremely rare. Meanwhile, in Blackjack, you get one every time you get a Blackjack, which happens once in every 21 hands. And the people that construct these things often don't know anything about the probabilities of these events and are just writing any old rules. So it pays to do your homework.
All right, enough about drawings. Michael, why don't you tell us who Don Schlesinger is and how come he's hanging on the phone line now?
Okay. Don Schlesinger is another one of the great names in blackjack to appear on Gambling with an Edge. Don started writing about the game in 1984 for Arnold Snyder's Blackjack Forum newsletter. After 13 years of addressing some of the most challenging questions in blackjack, Don put together the best of his work in his book, Blackjack Attack, Playing the Pro's Way. The third and latest edition of Blackjack Attack has over 500 pages of the fine points of blackjack. For true aficionados of mastering the game of blackjack, there is no substitute for Don's in-depth treatment of the game. Don doesn't just write about the game, but he has been playing it at a high level for decades. I've seen him in action. He appears to be nonchalant as he makes small talk at the table while playing a clean game any counter would be proud of. Besides his mastery of blackjack, Schlesinger holds a bachelor's degree in mathematics and a master's of philosophy in French. While playing and writing about blackjack, Don somehow managed to also be a family man and have a successful 13 career as a New York investment banker after teaching for 16 years. On a personal note, Don has been a proofreader on my site for about 3 years. I've tried to pay him, but he won't hear of it. His guidance was tough at times, but it has helped my own writing a great deal, for which I am very thankful. Here to talk about the fine points of blackjack is Don Schlesinger. Don, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Oh, thank you very much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here, Mike and Bob, and I look forward to the show.
Well, thanks for coming on. Your first question, how did you first hear about that blackjack was vulnerable to card counting, and how did you start to get involved with playing the game?
Well, you mentioned I've been doing this for decades, so we may as well go back 50 years. Sounds pretty frightening, half a century. But that's when Ed Thorpe's seminal work on the game, Blackjack Beat the Dealer, first came out, 1962.
Yes.
And I can remember I was summering in the Catskill Mountains of New York, and I had a friend who worked at Random House. And I actually got an advanced copy of the hard copy, the original copy, of Beat the Dealer. And I was only 16 years old at the time, and I wasn't really interested in gambling. I was interested in mathematics and probability theory. Used to fool around with all the little paperback books that had puzzles and games with math and logic and what have you. And so I was reading this more from the point of view of somebody who was interested in the math than I was somebody who thought I'd ever go out and apply any of the content of the book. And again, since I was underage for gambling in a casino, I think the first time that I ever did play blackjack in a casino was probably 6 or 7 years later. And as I recall, it was in Puerto Rico, and it had nothing to do with card counting. So we kind of fast forward to the mid-1970s, and my first trip to Las Vegas was in 1975. And I was still just playing a basic strategy game, nothing to do with counting at all. And I can remember this because it's kind of ironic looking back. I was in the Stardust Hotel, and I went into the bookshop, and I saw Lawrence Revere's Playing Blackjack as a Business, one of the most respected books at the time on the game.
With full color charts.
Full color charts, his claim to fame, produced by Julian Braun. And I'm not ashamed to tell you, I stood there and thumbed through this book with whatever mathematical knowledge I thought I had, and my instant reaction is, my God, how could anybody do that? I would never want to be involved with anything so complicated. And I put the book down, and I never bought it. Well, about a year went by.
Did you steal it? No, I'm sorry.
No, neither that.
Sorry.
A year went by, and I started to read more about the game, and no matter where you read or what you read, it was Revere this and Revere that. So I said, you know what, I really have to get into this. And the publisher was Lyle Mann in Secaucus, New Jersey. And I simply wrote to them, asked for the book, got it, and spent most of the summer dealing cards on my kitchen table and trying to learn what this was all about. And I took one trip to Paradise Island in the Bahamas, the old Paradise Island Casino, before it became Merv Griffin, and then ultimately the magnificent Atlantis that's there today. And two more trips to Las Vegas that summer in August to attempt to count cards for the very first time for red chips, as I recall. And so that was the start of, as we say, you know, well, the rest is history.
All right, let me interrupt you. I'm just getting an idea that we give you a small question and you're going to talk for 6 minutes on whatever we ask you. So we, every now and then we have to start over again. Let's talk about your most famous work on the illustrious 18. The illustrious 18 gives 18 plays that are most important to card counters. I got lots of questions on it. One is, how come 18? Why not 16? Why not 23? Is there a big cutoff between 18 and 19, or what? So we'll start.
Well, there actually was, and you might know that later on we discovered four more, and kind of decided that under certain conditions, when you were spreading in a certain way or for particular games, that those extra four could indeed be worth just about as much as the bottom three or four on the original list. But
those dealt with surrender.
No. The surrender is different. So these were what I came to fashion as the catch 22. We added doubling 8 against a 5 and a 6. And we added doubling soft 19, ace 8 against a 5 and a 6. And so the short answer to the question is, yes, there really is a cutoff. You simply reach a point of diminishing returns where ranking the plays beyond that just doesn't give any bang for the buck anymore. So the cutoff was made at that point where we found that the trade-off for taxing your memory by learning any more plays as opposed to just sticking with the ones that were there wasn't such a good trade-off anymore. So you had to draw the line somewhere,
okay, and
we drew it there.
Now, on your article, at least in the current version of Blackjack Attack, the numbers that you use on this deal with the high-low counting system. Would it have been the same rules in the same order had you used high up one or two or a Revere's advanced APC or some other system, or would it be different?
They were very likely to be the same because the principle of all point counts are to separate high cards from low cards, locate the neutral ones, and just determine those situations where the deck is richer in high cards. And some counts do that somewhat more efficiently than others, but the bottom line is that's what this activity is. And the second power of a card counting system is to locate the strategy deviations, the effects of removal and how you might alter or deviate from basic strategy. So there again, there are minor differences in efficiency with the various counts, but it's unlikely if you try to fashion or craft an illustrious 18 for each individual point count that you would come up with anything different. At best, you might change the order slightly of some of the plays in the rankings.
Change
but
16
it would
and 17.
Make much difference.
Change 16 and 17, for example. Switch the order.
Yeah, so, and I don't think anybody would really care too much. So we're pretty confident that with the 18 and certainly with the 22, we've identified the most important plays. And then, as you mentioned before, we certainly wanted to add surrender when it's offered, and so four more plays in order to take advantage of surrender opportunities.
Thank you. Let's go back down memory lane again. In your early days, you worked closely with Jerry Patterson teaching how to count cards. I think you ran his Northeast operation. However, I think it would be... Bob is making a motion like I'm not supposed to ask this question.
I think we agreed not to ask this question. Is that your recollection, Don?
No, you can. We can discuss Jerry Patterson.
Yeah, okay.
I'm happy to talk about those days. They were fun up to a point.
Yeah, so I was going to say that he was a blackjack teacher, and you were assisted him, and but later he developed something called Target, which was basically a betting system, and I still don't understand how it worked. But he
it
was
didn't.
Yeah, he basically was excommunicated by the legitimate blackjack experts such as yourself, and you must have known Jerry Patterson. Did you know him both before and after Target? And tell us more about your relationship with him.
Jerry was a lovely gentleman. He was very knowledgeable, and he wrote two very fine books for the layman. They weren't mathematically intensive, but one of them was called, as I recall, Blackjack's Winning Formula, and the other, Blackjack, A Winner's Handbook. And they were two very fine reference books on the game. And then he founded a blackjack school. He called it the Blackjack Clinic, and it was headquartered in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, or Voorhees, New Jersey, southern New Jersey area. And he taught card counting in a class, and it was a wonderful class, very well conceived, very well taught by excellent instructors, including Jerry himself. And I wrote to him. I contacted him. I made some edits and comments on his books. And he met me one day in New York City. And he proposed to me that I run a franchise of the Blackjack Clinic in the greater New York metropolitan area. And I teamed up with a dear friend of mine, Ken Feldman. And he and I actually ran the franchise for 2 or 3 years, as I recall. And then Jerry came out with this new concept that he called Target, which was an acronym for table grading, some sort of system or whatever. And unfortunately, it was pure nonsense. He was sold a bill of goods by a gentleman named Eddie Olson, who was a newspaper reporter. And we speculate to this day whether Jerry knew that it was all voodoo and marketed it anyway, or whether he genuinely thought that it had some merit. But the bottom line is that when he asked us to begin integrating and incorporating that into our classes, Ken and I said we wanted absolutely nothing to do with it, and that we didn't want our integrity and our reputations to be associated with what we felt was snake oil. And we told Jerry that, but he was rather adamant that all of his franchisees now begin to teach this, and so we parted ways. And it was too bad, but the bottom line was that Jerry really sort of went off the deep end after that and began marketing just about every kind of get-rich-quick scheme, greyhounds, roulette, dice, trading options, anything that you can name. And he went in a very different direction than I certainly was interested in. And I must say that many years have gone by, but you don't really hear too much of him anymore, because after that Target fiasco, he kind of became persona non grata in at least the blackjack community.
Now, your book, Blackjack Attack, should be on the bookshelves of all legitimate blackjack players. If you, what other books and or software belongs on that same shelf, in your opinion?
Well, of course, there are some of the standards. So, for my money, one of the great books ever written on the game that has stood the test of time is Stanford Wong's Professional Blackjack. It's been lying on my desk for some 30 years since he wrote it, and I refer to it very frequently, as I do the theory of blackjack. which is probably the greatest mathematical work ever written on the
Peter
game
Griffin.
By the late Peter Griffin. And beyond that, for historical reference, I certainly would take a look at Playing Blackjack as a Business, the Revere book that we mentioned, and of course, Ed Thorpe's Beat the Dealer for historical value. Bryce Carlson's Blackjack for Blood is an excellent book and one that I have valued over the years. And Ken Houston's Million Dollar Blackjack. I'm certainly leaving out some. Arnold Snyder's Black Belt in Blackjack is a highly respected work. Of course, nowadays we have computers and software, and the granddaddy of them all is Casino Verite and the suite of products that Norm Wattenberger puts out. He's really not only in first place, but there is no second, and his work is unparalleled in the field. It has many different components, but for those interested in computer software, that's the place to go. John Austin's Blackjack Risk Manager is another very, very fine work. And then, of course, there are the websites themselves. And Wong has BJ21.com. Victor Knack has AdvantagePlayer.com. And I have my Don's Domain site housed there. But I'll toss some kudos to Mike, because for my money, on the internet, you can't find a better all-inclusive gambling site with more reliable information on all of the games and with a spectacular section on blackjack and all of the appendices that contain a wealth of information. And that, of course, is Wizard of Vegas and
WizardOfOz.com.
WizardOfOz.com.
I agree.
And that is a spectacular site.
Well, thank you very much. Coming from you, that means a lot to me. Another one of your contributions to blackjack has been to assess the value of any given blackjack game according to a metric known as SCORE, which is an acronym for Standardized Comparison of Risk and Expectation. Can you tell us more about how the SCORE is calculated and which games tend to be more or less profitable than might be gleaned from the expected value only?
Well, the principle of SCORE was interesting because some people know that I have a background in investment banking and options trading and finance, and I worked for an investment bank for some 13 years. One of the principles of investing when you're looking to see what kind of a return you can get from an investment is that the return shouldn't really be everything. And that you should also consider the risk that you take in order to achieve that return. And the Nobel Prize in Economics was given to William Sharp, who actually conceived of the idea of actually forming a ratio of putting the expectation in the numerator of a fraction, so you want that to be as big as possible, but also putting the standard deviation or the variance in the denominator of the fraction, and you'd like that to be as small as possible because a fraction's value gets larger if the denominator gets smaller. So we formed this idea of the Sharpe ratio, and it occurred to me one day that that's really the best way to evaluate the goodness, if you will, or the attractiveness or the profitability of a blackjack game. What you really need to do is consider not only the return that you can get from the game, but also the risk or the standard deviation that you take when you play that particular game. And it's only when putting them on that equal footing that you can rank games appropriately. So I set out to do that, and you have to make certain assumptions so that you're comparing apples to apples. And so I arbitrarily decided that, you know, we'll use a $10,000 bankroll and we'll bet optimally and we'll assume certain rules tables, and we'll put so many people at the table, and we'll play high-low, and we'll spread from 1 to 6 or 1 to 8 or whatever the case may be. And I started to rank all the games. And then when I finished doing that, I started to use different count systems and rank and compare them. So it grew to be a tremendous study where I had all of these values for all these different games that could now be compared. And then I tried to get clever, and I said, well, these are really scores of all of these games. We're grading them. And then I tried to backfit an acronym into SCORE. And I got lucky with playing around with the words, and I think that standardized comparison of risk and expectation really fell very nicely. And if I must say so myself, I was rather pleased with the acronym.
Well,
so basically, this has become something that's really been embraced by the blackjack community, and along with the illustrious 18 of all of the studies and the research and articles that I've written, I think this is the one that's become most universally used and recognized and acknowledged by blackjack players.
Very good. Now, in video poker writing, the main differences between authors is how we can simplify a strategy. Getting the exact strategy is relatively easy if you have the computers, but different authors vary as to how it is simplified. Now, looking at Blackjack Attack with its hundreds of tables with thousands of entries in it, there's far more information than anybody could possibly absorb. And so it seems like the goal among blackjack authors is to find the truth, no matter how complicated it is, and simplifying it, other than SCORE, other than Illustrious 18, is not part of the game. Now, am I missing the boat on this, or is this a fact?
I think you might be missing the boat a little bit, only to this extent, Bob. All of those charts, all of those tables, all of the painstaking crunching of the numbers is there. But usually, in order to draw some conclusion or make some point, and so I might have written 15 pages leading up to the Illustrious 18 with a lot of fancy math and calculations, which was actually guided by Peter Griffin, and I thanked him in the book for his advice.
Yes, he did.
But all you really need to take away from that would be the bottom line, would be kind of the fruits of the labor, and what we do with it. So there's a tremendous amount of charts and tables and numbers, but you're not really expected to know them, memorize them, or really use them for the majority of the time that you're playing. They're just a means to an end, and they get us to the conclusions that we'd like to draw. But they're not like as intimidating as you would make them out to be, because we're not asking you to digest all of this material, but rather take our word for the conclusions that we draw and then try to apply those principles to playing the game.
Okay. Blackjack in general, it seems like a lot of the counters that I know don't count anymore, that they've moved on to other advantage plays, and some people give an excuse that they're not welcome any place anymore, and some say it's too easy to get detected. Some people say it's just more profitable to play this or that. So do you find the same thing, that card counting is becoming a smaller piece of the advantage play pie, and have you taken up any other forms of advantage play?
Well, let me answer the first question. Yes, it's undoubtedly true that the pure lone card counter, not affiliated with any of the team-type structures that we know about, is becoming a dying breed. And I think this is true for a number of reasons, and you touched upon some of them. The game itself has gotten harder. Four decks became six decks on the strip. Six became eight. Rules changed. It was unheard of to have hit 17, hit soft 17 on the Las Vegas Strip, and now it's a common sight. Then they completely made a fiasco of the game by even calling it blackjack when they started paying 6-5 for naturals in single deck. So the rule changes, and the willingness of casinos to adopt those rules certainly hurt the game in general. Then you mentioned about not being welcome. The surveillance techniques got more sophisticated as technology and computers had the capability to do things that weren't available 40 years ago. And so people were getting detected more frequently, and longevity was being affected. And ironically, I think the corporate aspect hurt a great deal as well. Casinos used to be privately owned or individual entities, and then along came the big conglomerates, Harrah's and MGM, owning, you know, half of the strip. And so if you got backed off or barred from play in a single casino in the old days, it meant nothing to walk out the door, walk into the next one, sit down, and not worry about anything. Well, nowadays, if that casino is owned by the same one where you got backed off, they're waiting for you before you ever sit down at the table. And the photos and the flyers are sent out and the phone calls are made. So it's become extremely difficult under these conditions to ply your trade in quite the same way as you used to. And then, of course, you're right about the final piece of the puzzle. Very clever people, when their backs are against the wall, find other ways to make money. And so other types of advantage play, James Grosjean's two marvelous books, Beyond Counting and the sequel to that, identified lots of other ways to make money in a casino, and other ways at blackjack as well to make money, shuffle tracking, hole carding, or what have you. And people were finding that the returns were better than from straight counting and harder to be detected as to what you were doing. So they looked elsewhere, and that really became the wave of the future, which is the present right now, as card counting becomes somewhat less attractive when compared to these other possibilities.
Don, thank you very much for sharing with us tonight. You have been gracious with the information you have. Thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. I enjoy your show, and good luck with it in the future.
Yeah, thank you very much, Don.
Okay, good night, Mike.
Good night. So, Mike, what did we learn tonight?
I have read Don's book quite a few times. I often refer to it. So to be honest, I already knew a lot of that. I did not know much about Don's early history as a basic strategy player at first, and it does not surprise me that he initially took an academic interest in the game as opposed to making money, as I think that was the angle that I took as well when I first started. You know, I also did not know a lot of that stuff about Jerry Patterson.
Yeah, for me, Don has been known as somebody who, a man is known by the enemy he creates. And so he's had arguments with lots of people we've had on the show. And so tonight I found him and I was nervous that it would turn into be an unpleasant evening. This was a very pleasant interview. I'm glad he was on.
Me too.
All right, what's new and different at your various Wizard websites?
Last week I was in San Diego all week, so that was a week where pretty much nothing was accomplished on my sites. After I got back, I added a review of the Diamond Casino in Macau to my Wizard of Macau site. Wizard of Vegas, nothing much is going on there. Haven't added anything to Wizard of Odds this week. I would like to say that I mentioned before that I'm developing a website in Spanish. It's up now. It's at lasapuestas.mx. However, there's nothing in Spanish there right now. We pretty much just copied the Wizard of Odds over to Las Apuestas and are going to gradually replace the English content with Spanish as we translate it. But it's fair to say that my latest site has been conceived, which is a big moment for me, and I'm hoping to have that available to the public sometime this summer.
Are you personally fluent in Spanish?
No, my Spanish is...
¿Cómo está usted?
Oh, muy bien.
Ah, good, okay.
Y tú, or I might say y vos if I were not in Argentina. I can read Spanish fairly decently, but I'm nowhere near good enough to do a good translation. Never mind the fact that a lot of the terminology in gambling, you just are not going to find the term in any dictionary. And lots of times they use the English word in Spanish-speaking countries, and sometimes they might use different ones in different countries. So
good, this will be good.
So, but this is definitely going to be a site where I am pretty much outsourcing just about everything, and I'm just the wizard behind the curtain.
Yeah, well, I know a lot of students in my classes sometimes have English is not their first language, and if other sources of good information were available in their own language, Spanish is one of them. There are other languages too. You want to do a Korean website and a Filipino website, and there's all kinds of Chinese website. There's a good market for all those. The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else. If you played in the early hours part of Leap Day, February 29th, between the hours of midnight and noon, you receive single points unless you request that you get double points. If you'd like to get double points, contact Cliff Page, spelled P-A-I-G-E, in person, via telephone, or by email at P-A-I-G-E-C at southpointcasino.com. If you don't ask, you won't get. They have free slot tournaments on Thursdays for which all sexy seniors 50 years of age and older are eligible. You get one free entry, and you can earn up to two additional ones at the rate of 250 points apiece. You keep the points. A total of 30 winners share $5,200. At the Palms, the play, earn, and win promotion for the first half of the month, which ends tomorrow, is you can earn Apple gift cards, binoculars, tarps, and fly swatters. Now, starting Monday, you can earn Visa cards, among other things. We do not have the total gift selection yet, but it's expected that the gift cards will be at a 0.25% rate, meaning for a $100 gift card, it's going to require 40,000 same-day points in video poker. There are Apple Cash drawings Friday and Saturday evenings throughout the month, 10 winners each night. Prizes are iMacs, MacBook Airs, iPad, iPod Touch, and iPod Shuffles. In addition to the Apple prizes, the cash prizes range between $3,000 and $100. Virtual entries are earned during the week by your play and discarded after each week's Saturday night's drawing. You must be there to win. At videopoker.com, the tournament this month is going to be 10-play Ultimate X. These contests begin on the 23rd of the month and go through the end of the month. Now, there are hundreds hand sessions, and you can play as many of them as you want. Now, in most of their sessions, being dealt royals is what it takes to win. Ultimate X is probably something different, because in Ultimate X, you get a score, you get a multiplier based on a hand that you get, which affects... what you get next time. So if you get for example, you're playing deuces wild, a straight flush, if you're dealt straight flush, which isn't that rare, it's a 12x multiplier on all 10 hands. And then if you get a good hand next time, that can outdo a dealt royal. So a curious part of this is the first prize, which is, I think, $500 each month, is they have a bonus prize that you kind of go through backwards of getting, for the person who gets the most multipliers for which he scores zero. So if in the example you were dealt something with a 12x multiplier on all the lines, if you could arrange to get zeros on the next hand, then that would be 120 towards the booby prize. Now, the booby prize is a gold membership for a year, which is $79.95. So it's not as big as a $500 first prize, but it's not too shabby either. So it's a kind of curious strategy. Michael and I were playing around with it a little bit, but we decided we weren't going to invest a whole lot of energy on something with a first prize of less than $80. Also, on their site, Build a Wheel Poker is now available for gold members. You can play it and practice it. I'm going to be doing an article on it. Shaq already has an article on it on wizardofodds.com that I'm not going to look at until after I write mine. Hopefully, I can come up with something different than he has. We shall see. But that's Build a Wheel. It's now available. All right. Who's going to be on next week?
Next week, and I hope I pronounce this right, is Mark Gretzky. He is the a gaming writer for the Pittsburgh, gosh, now I don't remember the name of the newspaper, but the big newspaper in Pittsburgh. And he interviews me sometimes. I'm often helping him with the mathematical elements of his articles. So he is, I think, also a strong player advocate. I know that he was very big on a law in Pennsylvania that blackjack must pay 3-2. And I think he had a lot to do with that. Some of his recent articles were about not to be deceived by promotions, advertising claiming hot slots, and something about smoke-free casinos, and a warning about the lucky lady side bet. So we'll talk about some of his articles that he's written recently.
All right. So we got about a minute and a half to go, Mike. Now, you've been on cruises before, and have you, usually gambling in cruises is a pretty salty deal. Have you found advantage plays gambling-wise on cruises that you can share with us?
My big advice would be to ask for a fun book. When I did the Norwegian cruises, they had a pretty lucrative fun book for anyone who wanted it, and it was worth roughly about $100.
This is old news. They no longer have the fun book on Norwegian.
So
do we have another?
To be honest, not really. I was card counting on the Norwegian Star, and I did not last very long because somebody in surveillance was suspicious of me, and they Googled my name, and that pretty much ended that.
Well, there are advantages to pseudonyms. although in Vegas, all the casinos know the name on my driver's license, but in certain other casinos.
And you did it the right way. If I had it to do all over again, I would be known as something else, some other moniker.
Yeah, well, it's hard to start over again a second time. We also had a note today from Nolan Dalla, who will from the World Series of Poker. He'll be a guest within a few weeks. So go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and wizardofodds.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. Our sponsors are the South Point Hotel Casino and Spa, the Palms Casino Resort, the website videopoker.com, and the website wizardofodds.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.